Today on The Grave Talks, the Nickerson Sneed House. Generations called the Nickerson Sneed House home. Now, many of those who once lived behind these walls have returned from the dead to share a glimpse into the life they once led. Do all these spirits know that we are catching a glimpse into their former lives, or are they trying to convey a message to the living today? Today on The Grave Talks, we discuss the current and dark past of the Nickerson Sneed House with paranormal investigator Jake Fife.
Well, the Nickerson Sneed is interesting because the paranormal activity doesn't just have to do with the location, the history that took place in the home. It has to do with kind of a bleed-in of around the area. See, the original part of the Nickerson Sneed House was a two-room log cabin that was built around 1744, 1745 by Francis King Cannon. But even before Francis King Cannon came to Glade Springs, Virginia, close by Nickerson Sneed, over the ridge, about half a mile away, it was a huge gathering area for the Cherokee Native American tribes and even the Shawnee Native American tribes. And this was an area, not just that little gathering spot, but pretty much everywhere around it was kind of like a safe zone where, hey, if we run into your tribe or your war party, we won't attack you, you won't attack us, we will trade. And once a year, typically around the fall, they would gather, different tribes would come to this one place, and they would do kind of like fall rituals. They would trade with each other. They would have feasts, almost like a Thanksgiving type thing. And one of the reasons that it said that they went there was because in that general area, there was a very strong spiritual presence. And there's a local legend around there that in the woods, the spirits would hide. That was the gathering place for the spirits of the region, and that on specific nights of the year, the spirits would come out of the forest. And so these Native American tribes, they would go there hoping that they could please the spirits and contact them. And so when Francis King Cannon came there, well, first, they were kind of run out pretty quickly by some of the local militia in the area because they had had some issues with them in the past. And so Francis King Cannon, he came from Ireland, and he went to Pennsylvania, didn't really do well in Pennsylvania, and he had a brand new daughter, and he basically just wanted a fresh start. He was like, well, Pennsylvania is not really working for me. He didn't get along with some of the people. He had some problems with some of the local law enforcement from what we've been able to tell. So he was a surveyor. That's what he became when he came to America. He was originally just a regular farmer. And he started doing scouting trips into Virginia. And one of the people that he used to ride with was George Washington on scouting trips. And so he discovered this little area towards the bottom of Virginia near the North Carolina border, which is modern-day Glade Springs. And he decided in 1744 that he was going to move his entire family there, which at the time was a little crazy because no one else was living there. Now, the county militias, they would patrol through there. But pretty much everyone stayed away from that area, like I said earlier, because that was the big meeting place of these tribes. And it was known as a place where if you went there to move, you probably weren't coming back alive. And so he went against everyone's opinion and judgment, and he took his family down there. And along the way, he met a few other people, and they kind of joined and formed like a mini wagon train. And when they got to Glade Springs, he set up his little cabin, and they set it up originally as a cabin, and then they transformed it into a bit of a fort. And during the French and Indian War, it saw a little action. Most of the action in the area actually took place about a mile and a half away. There were some little skirmishes, not really anything big, but from what I've been able to gather in my research, the house was attacked at least once. And after a while, he started having some more kids, and he had this son, his oldest, Andrew King Cannon, who later became a lieutenant in the Continental Army and fought at King's Mountain during the Revolution. He started teaching him how to be a surveyor and a tracker, and that's pretty much what the King Cannons were known for. They were, if you wanted to know what was over that ridge that no one had dared go over, you asked Francis King Cannon and his son. If you wanted a road cut out, you called Mr. King Cannon. And so they started getting more friends that way. They started to make some pretty good money. And after about 10, 15 years of living pretty much alone, aside from one other family in the Great Streets area, more and more people started to go there. And Francis King Cannon did carve out a wagon road that went in front of his house, which is still there to this day. And Glade Springs started becoming what it is today. And his family oversaw everything. They owned about 85% of the town. And, you know, they were just very big figures to the point to where they had sway over the local and the county courts. Which, you know, they had a few issues that popped up every once in a while, but for my record, the issues disappeared. And, you know, if you put two and two together, it's kind of easy to tell why they disappeared as fast as they did. And then when the Revolutionary War came to the area, now, Francis King Cannon, he was still alive. He didn't die until about the mid-1780s. So about the Revolutionary War, he was still alive. And Glade Springs, because that was the only road in front of his house. And his house was an old decommissioned fort. It was restored back to its fort status. And it was used as a recruitment center a little bit for, you know, the local militia captains would go there. They would offer food and drink and get people to sign up. And that was the most traveled road for militias and even an army going down south to the Southern campaign. And there were some skirmishes during the Revolutionary War in West Virginia, southern West Virginia, and then southern Virginia. Most of the action was between Native Americans and settlers. It wasn't really American versus British. And so around the Glade Springs is the kind of action that it saw. And one of the big things that the house contributed to was it was a field hospital. And during the march to Kings Mountain, a few regiments that ended up joining the Over Mountain Men to take down Patrick Ferguson at Kings Mountain, they ended up resupplying and tending to their wounded at the Nickerson-Sneed House before traveling down, you know, for the battle. So the house has had a lot of history, very interesting history. Now, Francis King Cannon and his wife did die in the house. He did expand it to another room, so it was a pretty good-sized cabin, especially for the time. And his son, who was a lieutenant now, Andrew King Cannon, he ended up taking over the house, but he sold it in the 1810s, I believe it was. And the person that ended up getting it, which is weird because there's not really records of this exact deal. It's more of like, what I'm assuming it was a verbal deal. It didn't go much into handwriting. But it eventually got down to this one family. I'm wanting to say it was a young family. I believe that was the name, but don't quote me on that. And they had an older son. And in the 1820s, he married this girl named Betsy. And Betsy was just a local girl who, you know, her family had a good bit of land in the Glade Springs area. But the young family, you know, they basically inherited all of the King Cannon stuff. The King Cannon just said, here, we're, you know, picking up shop and we're going west. And so they just gave everything to this family. And so Betsy ended up marrying into this family, but her husband died after about a year and a half of being married. Now, they did have a son together. And so Betsy, when he died, she got the entire property. She got the estate, all the land he owned. She got the house, the servants, the slaves, which at the time was a little weird because typically, you know, you give it to your next kin, you give it back to your family, your mom, your dad, something like that. And so there was a little bit of animosity between his family and Betsy because, you know, they're like, well, who are you? You've only been here a year, year and a half with us. What makes you think you're really entitled to all of this? Mm-hmm. And then enter Dr. Nickerson Sneed. He ran a local practice, and he had a decent amount of land, but from everything I've seen, he was a very ambitious person. And I think he saw opportunity, and he very quickly struck up a relationship with Betsy. And before you know it, they got married. And so that's how it became the Nickerson Snead House. About 1828 is about when this is. And so everything, one of the first things he had done was everything was transferred into his name, not her name. That includes all the property, everything they owned. So at this point, Dr. Nickerson Snead, he still retained his old property. So kind of like the King Cannon, he owned about 85% of Glade Springs. And he kept up with the old church, which Francis King Cannon had set up. He helped maintain it. He donated to the local causes. He helped his medical practice up a little bit, which he used his house for. He used one of the rooms in the cabin. They were still living in the cabin at this point. I don't see how at this point, but he was using one of the rooms as a doctor's office. And about 1835, he decides, you know, this is a little too cramped, especially with two kids now and my doctor's practice, which is the only one in the area for like an hour and a half, 2 hours. So he starts building brick add-ons to the house. Now, something that they used to do back then is when you wanted to make an addition, you didn't exactly tear down what was there before. Now, typically, if it was a cabin, you would, because, you know, brick and cabin doesn't really go well together. It looks weird. But for some reason, Dr. Nickerson Snead, he decided to keep the cabin. And he ended up building a house around the cabin. And still to this day, if you go into the dining room portion and one of the back room portions of the Nickerson Snead house, you're walking on the exact wood floors that Francis King Cannon built in 1745. And I have seen these for myself. The loft that was, you know, the outside of the cabin, the walls, they are still there. What Dr. Nickerson did, he literally just built around, he kind of encased it inside this new house. And he made it into a two-story, very, very nice plantation house. And he added an upstairs, which was just one room. And it was kind of like a little side room upstairs, up some stairs. And that was his doctor's office. And over time, you know, the smell of, you know, sometimes people would die in his office. We aren't sure how many exactly died, but it said more than a few died in his office. The smell would kind of creep down into the house below. And so he ended up building a little bit more of an expansion around it, kind of to block in the smell, and he closed in his office a little bit more. And so, you know, the Sneeds, they had a pretty good little setup in the area. Dr. Nickerson, he was involved in some of the local markets. He basically had not really complete control of the town, but a lot of the wheeling and dealings went through him when it came to what happened in Glade Springs. And he was very instrumental in taking Glade Springs from, you know, just this, hey, there's one road in a cool little town, check it out, to, hey, this is a major depot of supply. This is where everyone with a wagon train, everyone with supplies and army stops and resupplies and, you know, takes a breather. And Dr. Nickerson Snead was very key in that. And so about in the 1850s, everything's going well. And then he started expanding a little bit more north. And some of the people that were already up there, they didn't like that. And so there was a little bit of verbal exchanges between them. There was a little bit of court dealings, which Dr. Nickerson Snead eventually won. And there was the first bit of tragedy that he experienced around that time. And that was, he had this servant. I can't remember his name, but, you know, that was his favorite person on the property. And that servant, you know, they stayed on the grounds and that he built him like a small little, it's almost like a cottage looking thing. And, you know, that's where he lived, close to the house. It's where the other servants and the other slaves, they ended up a little bit further down the road, because, you know, back then they didn't build the servants' quarters close to the house. But for this one, he did. And there was one day when the servant, he was kicked in the head by a horse, and he was basically just sprawled out in the yard. He was pretty much dead. But Dr. Nickerson, he thought he could bring him back. And so he rushed him up into the office, basically told everyone, leave me alone until he's back to life. And he started working on that servant for about a day and a half, even though he was pretty much dead when the corpse kicked him in the back of the head. And after a while, Dr. Nixon seen, I guess he finally realized there was nothing to be done, so he didn't bury him. That was the thing. He ended up taking, now this is something that did actually happen. We do know that this happened. He took off his flesh and then got his bones and boiled them and cleaned them up and basically turned him into a skeleton. And one of the reasons for this was he saw in a lot of modern clinics in towns like Richmond that a lot of these quote-unquote professional rich doctors had these cool-looking models of what the inside of the human body looks like. And you can see the skeleton in every bone, and the kids thought it was really cool. It made you look really esteemed and established. And Dr. Nixon Sneed, he wanted one, but he couldn't afford one. And so, you know, like I said, he basically transformed his old servant into a stand-up skeleton model. And he kept him in his office. It said that he took the boiled flesh and dumped it in the yard and didn't tell anyone what he did. What happened was everyone just walked in and was like, hey, you have one of those model skeletons, huh? Cool. But no one knew. And of course, you know, back then they didn't really care about the well-being of servants very often. So, you know, no one asked what happened to his body. So that stayed for a very long time. And something that I found that's a little disturbing was kids would come into his office. They would sneak. It's almost like a rite of passage for the kids. They would go upstairs and they'd be like, hey, it looks like a real dead body. I bet you can't steal a bone from it. I bet you can't take a finger. And you know, it turns out it was a real dead body. And so over time, you know, more and more pieces of that guy's skeleton would be missing. So Dr. Nickerson, he got very angry about this. And he ended up taking the skeleton out and he buried it somewhere in the yard of the side of the house. We don't know exactly where, but all it's known is it's somewhere in the yard close to where his office was. And about this time, his wife had another child. And then the Civil War came. And the Civil War, for a place that was a major hub of activity, it didn't really experience too much action, aside from some troop movements, some resupplying, but that was really it. The house was used as a field hospital and as a morgue during the war. And it is known that during some local skirmishes, mainly in 1864, some of the army, both Union and Confederate, they would take, you know, their wounded and dead and have Dr. Nickerson patch them up. And for some of them, they would take their bodies into the basement, which they transformed into this big morgue. And if it was wintertime, you couldn't bury people because the ground was frozen solid. And so they would just leave the bodies there until spring. And so, you know, in war, a lot of people tend to die. And Dr. Nixon said he was a good doctor, but he wasn't good enough to perform the operations needed to save a lot of lives. And so, you know, bodies started racking up quickly inside the basement. And so it got to the point to where sometimes they would even be stacking bodies on the stairs going down to the basement. And then eventually they would take the bodies either back to their homes or they would bury them in the local cemetery, which is about half a mile away. And then in the 1870s, Dr. Nickerson Sneed, he died. And then his wife died. And the Mason family took over. Now, the Mason family, when they took over, they had the house from about the late 1870s up until, I believe, about the 1970s. It went through the family almost 100 years. Instantly, when they came in, there were ghost stories of the old doctor still in his office, and people would see the woman in blue walking around the house. And, you know, that was Betsy Sneed. And so the Mason family, they kept it. They did a little work on it. It was a very strange design because Dr. Nixon Sneed, when he would add additions to the house, he wouldn't tear down what was there before. He just kind of encased everything. Like, there was a point in, I believe, the late 1840s, outside his office, he put another room. and then he had like a little porch where you can walk on, people can stand and wait until it's their turn. And in the 1860s, he built a few more bedrooms, and he decided, well, I'm just going to make this an upstairs. And instead of taking down the porch, he just enclosed it, encased it. And that's why when you're in the building today, it's a very weird feeling going up the stairs because, you know, there's brick next to you. You can tell that there's an outside window on the inside. It doesn't look right. And then when you get upstairs to the quote-unquote landing, it feels and looks like a back porch. It's just very weird. And then we get to about the 1930s when the Mason family still has it. And there was a death that was not really strange, but it could have been prevented. There was someone who had a little bit of a heat stroke. And, you know, the family, they took them out to the back porch and said, oh, crap, we have to go call somebody. And, you know, they left the person there. No one was watching them. And that person apparently did try to call for help a little bit, but no one heard them because, you know, people were inside calling, I guess, the local ambulance, or, you know, they were freaking out. And that person ended up dying on the back porch. And that was, for the Mason family, a little bit of a traumatic event. It was said that the house was never really as cheerful as it once was. And it's also said that paranormal activity increased. So the house, it hasn't seen many owners since it was built in the 1740s. And even going back to the 1870s, 1880s, it has a reputation for being haunted. Now, a lot of psychics that come in, for those of you listening out there, you can take psychics as you will, whether, you know, at their word or with a grain of salt, whatever you believe. But a lot of them have said that because the Cherokee tribes were run out of their fall festival area and out of their spiritually rich and important environment, that there is a little bit of a curse put on the place, that, you know, nothing will ever truly thrive here. And that some of the spirits of the woods, they were basically sent to run those people out of what's the Nickerson Sneed House. So it's very strange how all of that just kind of comes into play in a place that has not seen as much death and as much trauma as some other places, but it's still more active than other places based on what took place around the area, not just in the house.
Sure, very... Very active piece of land with a lot of stuff that occurred there and within its walls itself. When we start talking about the property having haunting occurrences going on in it, people are recognizing there is something odd going on here. When does it actually start to go from just, oh, there's rumors of ghosts, to people actually looking into the place in early forms of ghost investigating? What are some of those? Who are some of those people, and when did that start?
That started about in the 1980s, okay, when the current owners, Rhonda Caudill and her husband, they bought the place from the Mason family. And I've talked to her many, many times about this. And she said, well, as soon as they came in, when they were looking at the house, because, you know, it was a similar path. They were from Northern Virginia, I believe, and they were just looking for something new. They wanted something old, something cool looking, because, you know, they're even back then they were into the paranormal and just creepy houses. And she told me that their agent was like, here, I've got this place, and this place, but here, let's go look at it. And she was like, well, as we're going by, there was one place slightly out of our budget, but our agent listed it for some reason as, hey, it's out of your budget, but it's a cool house and it's old. Let's go check it out. And so she said as soon as they got there, it was as if the house was calling her, as if, you know, it wouldn't let her leave without her agreeing to buy the place. And they took a walk around, and she said it's weird. It was as if she had been there before. It felt like a very strong sense of deja vu. She knew, strangely enough, where everything was. She was able to get around the house, not really any problems. And so they ended up buying the house. And as soon as they moved in, because originally it was just going to be, you know, their house. And then they started hearing footsteps. Then they started seeing the woman in blue, which is, like I said, Betsy Sneed. They didn't have any experiences with Dr. Nickerson Sneed. Not really anyone has. anymore, aside from a few one-off occasions. But it's mostly Betsy Sneed that people have experienced, mainly Rhonda and her husband. And then there's two little kids, Josephine, and I can't remember the name of the other one, but they are from the Mason family. And I'm not really sure if there were kids that died in the home or something like that. That bit of history hasn't been clear to me, but they haunt the place. And there's this one specific kid's room that they had set up, and it was kind of when they first moved in, it was a little bit of a storage room. So not many people were going in and out of there. And if you know how paranormal experiences work, paranormal activity works, typically spirits will take up residence in a room in a house that doesn't see a lot of human traffic. Kind of like, you know, like their own room, a place where they can have privacy, a place of kind of like a base of operations. They can manifest and come and go as they please. And that's kind of what that room became when the Caudills moved in. And first it was just the two little kids. They would hear what sound like kids playing. There was this little toy piano that sometimes, it's very creepy. It is one of the creepiest pianos I've ever heard. And sometimes they would hear a few notes being played on it, which for me at that point, I would have probably sold the house at that point. But it was really just something to where, you know, it freaked them out at first. It disturbed them. And then they just kind of learned to live with it. And then there would be nights where it would sound like the front door was kicked in by the SWAT team, like they were coming to get you. And so they go downstairs and the door's locked. The door's fine. And then they go back to bed. It'd be the same thing, but the door's locked. It's front and back. It's bolted. It's an old lock. And then they would hear it again on another night, and this time the door would be open. And that's something that still happens to this day. I've actually witnessed this myself during a seance, the front door sounding like it was kicked in really hard. And that was something that started happening a bit more and more. And something that ended up happening as well was a little bit before the Caudills bought it. The Mason family had an antique store that was there, and this must have been about the 50s and 60s is about when this was, and one of their sons was an avid collector of mainly everything, and one of the things that he just happened to be collecting that was in very high demand for his business was creepy dolls. And there was one story, I did talk to a member of the Mason family about this, and she told me that there was one doll that came in one day that he bought in, I believe it was the Chesapeake Bay, I think is where she said he bought it from. But ever since he brought that doll in, a lot of activity has kind of skyrocketed. And that doll has been seen moving by the Mason family. It would change positions sometimes. They would hear a female voice that would seemingly be coming from the doll. And so eventually they got rid of the doll. And they got rid of the other dolls just in case they decided to make their presence known. And the antique store went on for a little bit more, and then they transformed it into a restaurant. And then during this restaurant time, people would complain almost nightly that, hey, we came in your restaurant, and this woman in a beautiful blue dress would look at us, but she wouldn't feed us. And it's like she wasn't there. She wouldn't respond to us. She wouldn't help us with our questions, nothing. And so the owners, they'd be like, what girl in a blue dress? And then, you know, that's when the customer's like, ah, and they start freaking out because, you know, who is this phantom hostess? Sure. And, you know, like I said earlier, the woman in blue is Betsy Sneed. And apparently she is very, very attached to the location. And every single time, whether a new family would come in or basically a change was made to the house, she would be seen almost nightly, and she would always make her presence known, kind of just what I gather to keep track, make sure, you know, they're not destroying the house, they're not desecrating it. And so that's really when they start doing quote-unquote investigations about the 1990s. And then the Caudills, they ended up moving out of the house, but they still kept, and they were originally going to make, you know, almost like a B&B type thing. They were going to rent it out to people. But some of the people that rented it out, you know, they complained about voices, sometimes hearing screams and moans, and, of course, the front door being kicked in. No one felt safe. And so About the early to mid-2000s is when they started having actual paranormal investigations there. And they had a few teams come in. About 2004, I believe, was the very first one. And it was a very supercharged location. And ever since that first investigation, it's almost like the spirits make it their mission to make their presence known.
When you're in there and in an investigation, what sort of feeling are you getting? Are these good spirits? Are these protective spirits? Is it a lot of different spirits that are present? What's going on with these spirits that are making themselves known?
Well, first, when you walk up to the building, when you get there, it almost looks like a scaled-down version of the Haunted Mansion. You drive up, there's this little ridge that you go up, and there's two pillars that have old-fashioned lanterns on them, and they're lit up. And then the house, there's just two windows that's usually lit at night, and it almost looks like an Amityville-type scene. And so when you go into the house, you're already a little creeped out, and you're walking up this old brick walkway that was laid down in the 1830s. You get onto the porch, you hear the creak of the wood. The door is a little stuck because, you know, it's been there since 1835, 1836. And as soon as you enter in, it's almost like you can feel people greeting you. And downstairs, especially in the front few rooms, it's a very welcoming environment. You know, you feel almost like whatever is there, you know, welcomes you. It's like, hey, welcome to the house. Make yourself at home. And then you go upstairs. And upstairs around the doctor's office, you get a sense that, you know, this is cool. I don't feel like I'm going to die here, but I feel like something's watching me. And so I do believe that even though he doesn't really make his friends known, I think Dr. Nickerson Sneed is still around his office. Mainly when you get upstairs, it's more of a, hey, glad you're here, but we're going to keep an eye on you kind of vibe. Until you get to the kid's room. Now, the kid's room is a creepy place. I don't like that room simply because some of the dolls from the antique store, they kept a few of them, it turns out, and they put them in there. And, of course, that creepy piano that used to play, it's still in there. There's some creepy paintings of clowns with happy and sad faces. Of course, I hate clowns. I have a fear of clowns. And some psychics have said that there is an elemental presence there that hides under the bed. And that's kind of like its manifesting point, and it comes out from under the bed and tries to chase people off. And one psychic came in and said, now mind you, she didn't know the history of this place. And she said she got a sense that it's Native American in origin. And so that kind of sparked the question, you know, is this a little bit, not really of the curse. Curse is kind of a wrong word, but basically the Cherokee tribe said, hey, this house, this area is going to be haunted forever. And so that started bringing that back. Could it be something that they summoned? Could it be a spirit of the forest? And it hasn't done anything too extreme, aside from creep a few people out. I thought I saw it one night, and it was kind of creepy. I did have an experience where it said that if you're in the room, you're trying to make contact with it, basically call it out. That sometimes you can hear the floor shake, and sometimes you can see what looks like a little black mass go out from under the bed, look at you, and if you look fast enough, it'll duck under the bed. But if you're not fast enough, it'll go out throughout the house. And some people say that's that elemental presence. But the weird negative side, there is a negative side to the activity there. That didn't really start until about a year and a half ago. And I was there about a year and a half ago, and I'm sure that's not related, even though I'm sure your listeners are probably thinking, huh, coincidence. But we did a Paracon event there, and during one of our seances, I got an idea that, you know, Dr. Nixon's team might not have been the world's greatest doctor, and, you know, there is a chance that he could have infected some people, maybe, with a disease that he did more business, and so I brought it up. And when I brought that up, the energy of the house got a little darker. And we started hearing knocking on the wall, coming in threes. And we started hearing faint growling. And mind you, this is with our own ears, not through any equipment, on a sound. We can hear this stuff. And ever since then. There are a few isolated incidents of growling and people being scratched before that, but after that seance and after that event, it seems like there's been off and on this not really evil but more negative presence that shows up every once in a while and sometimes will scare the crap out of people to the point where when some teams investigate there, they'll end up being in this one room the entire night almost because something spooked the crap out of them. And I've heard stories where teams have been investigating and they've seen something, not someone, but something in the kids' room, and then they won't investigate upstairs the rest of the night. Now, as for what they saw and heard, I don't know. They didn't really go into detail, but there's something that shows up that literally will run people out of the entire upstairs of the building.
Do you think that that has anything to do with making that accusation? I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of making an accusation like that of someone who is alive. If you are falsely accused of something and you're very proud of what you did and what your accomplishments were, and you really can't express it on the other side, other than anger, other than frustration, I do wonder, if this was, an accusation made just out of, question, if he's there, but he doesn't want that questioning to continue, not because necessarily that he did anything wrong, which I'm not saying he did or didn't, but
right,
but because of the fear of a reputation being tarnished that he can't really defend.
Oh, I think you're right. But I think there's actually a little bit more to that, because when I first started hearing about the negative activity, exactly what you just described is exactly what I saw, almost word for word. I was like, okay, obviously, like you said, you make an accusation, someone's going to get a little angry. But what about the people that aren't making accusations?
Yeah.
And so I started thinking a little bit more, and I contacted a few groups that, claim to have some experiences there. And they started describing, when we do a little provoking, we would talk about that, there would be this heat that would enter the room. And it would almost feel like, there was a cannonball in your stomach, which, I'm sure a lot of investigators are starting to figure out almost what it is. And every time I've encountered an evil entity, mostly non-human, that's a very telltale sign. Heat entering the room and almost like a cannonball in your stomach is what people describe. And that's something, when I was on your show talking about St. Albans, that's, exactly what I felt whenever I was in the presence of the demonic.
Sure.
Now, I don't think necessarily that it's a demonic presence, but what I'm thinking is that elemental force that has been there and has been an overall negative entity over, ever since it was summoned, basically, with its Native American connection, I think it's feeding off of that negativity. Even though the investigators, myself included, phrasing the question, setting up, we're not in a negative mindset, but that question does bring up negative energy because, you're assuming something negative about the reputation of someone who was and may still be there. And so naturally, that's going to create a negative environment. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it's feeding off of that. And I also think that it could be impersonating Dr. Sneed because, and I've talked to members of the Mason family. I've talked to Ron Caudill, the current owner, about it. There had been maybe one or two instances where they know Dr. Nickerson was experienced in the house. So you're talking about from the 50s up until now, only two incidents where, hey, we know that's Dr. Sneed. And so that leads me to believe, he might not be here unless it's in his office. So something else is eating that negativity that's being, in a way, directed towards Dr. Sneed. And, when people would bring up, hey, you're a fraud, you killed people, it would do something because, like, hey, Dr. Nickerson's responding to us. Let's keep doing it, see what else he'll do. And I believe, now my personal theory, it's feeding off of that. And then it's feeding off the natural energy that's in the area, that's tainted there. Mm-hmm. And that's my theory about what it is, what that presence is upstairs. And when my dad and I did our investigation there in March, when we were filming for our episode, we experienced something like that. We had something full out tell us to get out. We had the word demon come across a few times. We had something identify itself as him, and it would only identify itself as that. But it never tells us who him was. And every single time that we got those negative responses, it was either in the kids' room, close to the kids' room, or it was in the gift shop area where there is a lot of, there's Ouija boards, different things like that, stuff that some people would say, oh, this definitely attracts spirits.
Sure.
So that's my theory about what's going on. I don't know if that's something that can be proven, but that's something that, based on my experiences and what people have told me, that's what I'm leaning toward is happening.
So there seems to be something dark going on here, whether it be an angry old doctor who's still there or something feeding off that negative energy. And clearly there are other things in this house. When you have ghosts, if you will, it's such a broad term, but when you have ghosts and you have spirits from different time periods and seemingly different generations of the timeline of the history of this home, all haunting and making themselves known. Do you have any evidence that they're interacting with one another, or are they all seemingly on their own plane?
I do not have any evidence from my personal collection of them seemingly interacting with each other. Now, I do think that they can interact with each other. I think it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
As for whether or not they do, I don't know. But as from other groups, I haven't really heard of the spirits interacting with each other. That's something that is kind of weird about a lot of locations. You don't really hear about spirits interacting with each other, kind of, you know, picking up on a spirit conversation or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's possible, and in my first opinion, I do think that they do, even if we're not able to pick it up.
It's always an interesting question for me to ask, because I do get the answer to that as being yes quite often. However, most of the time, in fact, I think almost every time I've asked that question, it seems to be members of a same family or people who are in a location in the same time period where that rule seems to apply of them being able to interact with one another. It's one of those I'm kind of digging on when we hear stories like this of multiple generations and multiple years of people coming and going from a property, of can they interact if they are from a different time period? And I don't believe I've heard any evidence of that yet, but that's a big yet with everything that we talk about. Tell me about some of the other spirits who seem to be inhabiting the house that are fairly obvious and enjoy making themselves known.
Well, there's this Foo Dog statue, and it's great. I didn't know about this. Now, see, here's the great thing about our investigation. When we went there a year and a half ago, we didn't really know anything about the location. I think I described this last time I was on your show. I like to go into an investigation knowing as much as I can. And the Nickerson Snead House was the very first location that I went in blind. I knew a little bit of the history. I knew it was built in the 1740s, something like that. Dr. Sneed came in the 1830s, and then he died. That was basically all I knew. And I knew, oh, there's shadow people, there's a woman in blue. That was all I knew. And we had stuff happen, not really anything of crazy note. And then our second time around, because we were filming an episode, it's a little different. We had a bunch of people come in that we interviewed that worked at the local haunted house there, and that it investigated. And they started telling us stories of, like, for a little while there was this doppelganger that used to take the form of some people that would be in costume. And seemingly it would play tricks, play pranks on people, and it would scare them. And I kid you not, I couldn't believe it when the lady told me that sometimes it would stand at certain places, almost like a horror movie, and would scare the crap out of people when they come around the corner, or they would enter a room and it'd just be standing there making a scary face, and then it vanished. And so there is, some people have reported that doppelganger. There's this Foo Dog statue. I can't remember where they got it from, but it's a very old statue. And, you know, it's of a Foo Dog, and it just sits outside the gift shop. And some people, myself included, have heard it barking and growling. And we even recorded it over our spirit box of it, I kid you not, barking at us. And it's very weird when you're downstairs because the place, it doesn't feel right when you're there because, you know, you can tell the house was built in chunks. And so there are certain floors that aren't even. There are certain walkways that aren't even. And so the entire time you're there, you're kind of disoriented. You're, in a sense, you're always off balance. You're never completely settled and calm in that house. And, you know, you're going downstairs, you're half disoriented from everything. And they have a very creepy aesthetic there. They do a really good job with it. And it sets the mood for an investigation perfectly. And then you hear a barking sound, or sometimes you hear a growl. And you and whoever you're with, you stop and you look at each other like, did the statue just bark at us? And it's kind of comedic when it happens, but it's also creepy because, you know, you remember Goosebumps from the old series. Is this thing going to come alive and start attacking us?
Sure.
And so that's something that a lot of people have experienced. But as for, you know, main resident figures that's experienced there, it's mainly Betsy Sneed and the two kids. That's really the main consistent ones. And then every once in a while, that elemental presence from the kids' room, it makes its presence known. And then, of course, I believe kind of like it was a station in life for troops, hospitals, things like that. I believe it's also like that in the spirit world because there's evidence of a lot of spirits coming in and out of that place. They get certain names like Bob, Dave, different things like that. And then those spirits are never encountered ever again. So I think at one time there could be many spirits in the house, but as for the resident spirits, I believe it's just three.
What do you make of the dog? Of it's a statue. It was not obviously a living creature at one time, unless we're talking about right. A dog that was bronzed or something, and maybe there's something going on here. But what do you make of that, and why it is why it's doing anything? Because it just seems to be an inanimate object, and sometimes you have inanimate objects that have other things attached to them, but I would say rarely is it ever, you know, of the object itself.
Right, and that's what I believe is going on. I think that there is something, whether, you know, my gut instinct is it's probably that the prankster doppelganger is what they call it. I believe it could be that, and it's just something that it does to mess with people. That's what I think it is.
With the other ghosts that are haunting that house, with the Betsy and her family, do you think she's interacting with her children still?
I don't think so. None of the Sneed children have been encountered. It's been it's the two Mason. I know one is Josephine Mason, and I can't remember the other one's name. But there has been a third child spirit that has been seen in the upstairs in Betsy's room, which was, you know, as the name suggests, Betsy Sneed's room. And we're starting to think that, you know, that could be one of her kids. And, you know, so whether or not that can be proven, I don't know. But there is some interaction going on, whether we can see and hear it or not.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the intent here is of this haunting? Are they just at home? Are they just going about their daily lives on the other side?
Yeah. I mean, it's their home, especially Betsy Sneed. She's been there since about the 1820s.
Sure.
And, you know, that's home. Mm-hmm. And then for the Mason kids, I'm sure that I don't know exactly why they're in child form, if they, you know, died in a house as kids. I'm not 100% sure about that. But I believe that whether they died in a house and they're just stuck there or they feel a connection to it. Like, we have certain places that we like and probably in death we'll probably, if possible, visit. Sure. I believe that's what's going on.
What do you think, or is there any inclination as to how they feel, the spirits, how they feel about the home like this being used for haunted attraction, not just, you know, for serious investigation, but when they do some of the more Halloween-esque things? Is that a lack of respect? Is that something that they care about because it gives them attention, so it's a positive? How do you think they feel about things like that?
Oh, I think they see it as a positive.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's pretty much all the activity there is a calm and, like I said earlier, kind of a welcoming. Even during the haunted house stuff, there's there's a very welcoming energy when you go into the home. You know, it's almost like you're a long lost member of the family they want to reconnect with. That's a bit of an extreme analogy, but that's kind of what it feels like. And from all the stories I've heard, when it is transformed into a haunted house for a few months out of the year, the spirits seem to have fun with it. You know, sometimes they scare people, and it's weird because they'll see them on the track of the other actors, as if the spirits know, hey, this is where the guests walk, and this is where the quote-unquote monsters are supposed to be, and that's where they're seen. And so I think they're fine with the way things are going now, because they sense that the current owners, they value the house as much as Betsy Sneed did. And I think that, aside from the elemental presence, I think she's the main spirit that kind of oversees everything. Now, when you get into the Red Room, which was Dr. Nickerson's office, it's a bit more of a, hey, you should probably leave now energy. That's what a lot of people get from there. And I think that's kind of residual, possibly intelligent energy and manifestation of Dr. Nickerson.
That wraps up our interview with Jake Fife about the Nickerson Sneed House. Thank you to Jake for being on the program today. And of course, also thank you for supporting the programming and allowing us to be on the air. Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for your support.